I'm JG Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Before we get to this edition of the show, I just want to promote Wall Street Window, a website maintained by Mike Swanson that provides valuable insights on both financial markets and geopolitics. It's been around since 2003, and its slogan is "Be in the Know," and I highly recommend it as daily reading. So go on over to wallstreetwindow.com and keep yourself informed. This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick,
Meresham,
Galen, Arlen, Beau,
Christopher, Michael,
Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan,
David H, Y Kellerman, Saadad 13,
Kathleen, David,
Ava,
Bob,
The West Bank Robbery Podcast,
Jamie,
Enoch,
Gary,
Max,
Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho,
Brian,
Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, well, this is probably going to be one of the more controversial episodes in recent memory, as Professor Jody Dean joins us to discuss academic freedom and Palestine. For those not in the know, Professor Dean recently penned a piece on the blog of major left-wing publishing outfit Verso, entitled "Palestine Speaks for Everyone." In said piece, Professor Dean describes her reaction to the sight of seeing Gazan paragliders breaking their way into Israel as exhilarating. This caused a massive uproar as many, including her employer, President Mark Garan of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, described the piece as repugnant. Professor Dean's defenders, such as Vijay Brashad, say that Professor Dean was not talking about the killings that happened on October 7th, but rather the initial images of paragliders breaking through into Israel, and that said images were a powerful symbolic representation of Palestinians taking flight against Israeli occupation. At this point, it's worth noting that Professor Dean's piece should be understood in some ways as a response to Judith Butler's October 19th, 2023 essay in the London Review of Books, entitled "The Compass of Mourning," in which Butler condemned Hamas for the October 7th attack. I really suggest that my listeners read both Judith Butler's piece and Professor Dean's piece, as well as Judith Butler's response to Professor Dean's piece in the Verso blog. Judith Butler's response to Dean was entitled "There Can Be No Critique," which was published on April 16th, 2024. Regardless of one's views on Professor Dean's blog post, she has since been relieved of her teaching duties. This, in turn, has led to an outpouring of voices, including pro-Israel voices, including voices like that of Compact Magazine's Sarab Amari, who I would not consider an anti-Israel voice, to argue that while they may not agree with Professor Dean's views, the way Hobart and Smith colleges have responded to her blog piece amounts to viewpoint discrimination, thus making this an academic freedom issue. That was my interest in this story, and that's why I reached out to Professor Jody Dean. What you're about to hear is not a debate about her views on October 7th, but rather a conversation about academic freedom in relation to discussions of Israel-Palestine, and some talk about the heavy-handed police repression of protesters. Even with voices that I vehemently disagree with, I'm a big proponent of freedom of speech, particularly protected speech, and there is a difference between something like hate speech and protected speech. So, this conversation is about academic freedom more than anything else. I want that out of the way in advance. Keep that in mind when you're listening to this. Like I said, this is not a debate, and there wasn't even enough time to really debate. We only had a little over 20 minutes to conduct this interview, so with that being said, I present to you my conversation with Professor Jody Dean. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that has made a little bit of time to speak with me, and I appreciate that. Jody Dean is an American political theorist and professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in New York State. And she's the author of a number of books over the years. But right now we're going to be talking about what's happening with regards to a piece she wrote for the Verso blog entitled Palestine Speaks for Everyone and the fallout from that. Maybe you can just explain what has happened since she wrote this piece.
First, thanks for having me on. I'm really happy to get a chance to talk with you today. My piece dropped on April 9th, and a couple of days later, some Zionist groups on Twitter went nuts and started circulating it a lot and chastising me and calling me horrible things and saying awful things, and then targeting the school, Hobart William Smith, where I teach, targeting all of their accounts, saying, why do you employ this vile, hateful anti-Semite? They started calling out specific, somebody doxed me and put my work phone number and email out. And then some of the key administrators, including the college president's names and numbers out. And so then that occasioned a great deal of messaging to the college administration and trustees, all of which were calling for me to be fired because of my horrible text, actually because of one word in the horrible text, the word exhilarating, in the first sentence. Most people didn't seem to even read the entire piece. But then this led to my being publicly condemned at the faculty meeting. The president opened the Friday meeting by a kind of 5 minutes condemnation of me, which I guess it's good that I missed because I wasn't at the meeting. And then the next day he read the letter to me and added in that I had been relieved of classroom duties pending an investigation. And then, in case that wasn't enough, he circulated this letter to every student, parent, faculty member, staff member, and alumni from Hobart and William Smith. And so that created a great, big, intense situation.
With regards to the piece itself, if you want to give listeners an idea of what you were saying in the Verso blog, I think some of it was maybe in response to Judith Butler's own ideas and thoughts about October 7th. What was the gist of what you were trying to get at?
So the primary message of the piece is a message of solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for liberation. It's a piece that's trying to get across the idea that this is a freedom struggle, that this is part of a struggle for self-determination, and to point out that, you know, back, and I'm using the scholar Robin D.G. Kelly to make this point, that back in the 70s and 80s, solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for self-determination and national liberation was at the core of the international anti-imperialist left, right? Everybody knew that. That was just common sense. We are all on the side of Palestine. And in many ways, since the kind of particular form, say we could call it the neoliberal globalization form that imperialism has taken over the last 30 or 40 years, or the humanitarian form that has become so strong, the idea of solidarity with movements for self-determination, movements that may also incorporate armed struggle, that's been lost. And so I was trying to hold up the struggle for freedom and the respect and dignity that any struggle for freedom of an oppressed people deserves. And so, yes, there's a critical engagement with Judith Butler. I need to say that they have been very solidarity. They signed a petition on my behalf, even though I had criticized some of their earlier discussion or intervention on this. They wrote me a letter of solidarity. Of course, they don't agree with my argument, but this is what it should, this is what should happen, is when you disagree with someone, you don't simply, particularly if you're in an academic setting, you don't just condemn them, and you certainly don't relieve them from the classroom. You have a critical dialogue. And so I particularly appreciate, Judith Butler's solidarity on that.
So that leads into something I want to say here. I myself am more along the lines of Judith Butler's position, or even someone like Rashid Halidi. But what concerns me is, in your case, and I do think this is an academic freedom case, you know, there's another scholar that I talk to often that covers Israel-Palestine, and I'm not going to name him, but he is not pro-Hamas. He couldn't be painted that way. He's very critical of Israel, however. And he's having trouble getting speaking engagements now. He's having events canceled and, you know, magazine articles that he's writing, he's having to do multiple revisions because he responded to the October 7th attack by calling it a jailbreak. He wasn't even saying that he condones what happened, but he called it a jailbreak. And apparently that is now considered unacceptable and it can't be debated. So I feel like there is this problem now where the discourse is being limited, and I fear where things are headed with regards to academic freedom. Can you comment on that?
I think you're right to worry about what's happening to academic freedom. A number of scholars in Middle Eastern studies, scholars particularly of Palestine, have faced this kind of repression for years and years and have fought back against this kind of repression. And now we're seeing it spread. But why are we seeing it spread? We're seeing it spread because, in fact, the sort of dam is breaking and people are now becoming more and more aware of the restrictions on thinking, on publishing, on thought. My piece was also about restrictions on feeling, on what we're allowed, what anyone is allowed to feel with respect to the last 7-8 months. And so I think, we're seeing a real crackdown. It's not inaccurate to call it a kind of McCarthyism. But at the same time, and particularly in the last, 2 weeks, we've got these fantastic encampments going on, which lets us know university and college students are saying, we're on the side of truth. You can't just try to regulate every single thing everyone says in the interest of maintaining a lie and a fiction. So I think we're seeing, the reason it's so intense right now is we're seeing both at the exact same time. The really just unconscionable restrictions on speech, plus a kind of epic, generationally defining fight back. Right? I was just thinking about this the other day. Can you imagine if someone said something like, "I fully support every aspect of Israel's attack on Gaza"? Nobody would have a problem with that. I mean, well, some of us, we would have a problem with that. But in the media, the college presidents, mainstream media, no one would say a word about that. Like, that would be just fine. Even when they say, well, you know, the leaders of Israel are saying that we have to wipe them all out. They're like, well, that's their view. And that's permitted speech. Right? But if you say people are fighting back against, you know, the 75-year Nakba, a colonization, being colonized, being occupied, being oppressed, the siege. If you say anything like that, it's like, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no. But, and so this tells us we're dealing with viewpoint discrimination, which is a fundamental free speech issue.
Can you speak more about that? What, for people that may be unfamiliar, what is viewpoint discrimination in academia?
Viewpoint discrimination is when the content of someone's speech, the perspective from which they're raving it, is the grounds for which someone's discriminating against. Any kind of regulation on what speech is in an academic setting needs to be neutral. So you can say things like, oh, your group can't use this room, but the reason you would say your group can't use this room is it's already being used, or your group is too big and you need a different room. You can't say your group can't use this room because you are supporting Palestine or because this is a pro-Palestinian gathering. But yet what happens and what's been happening is that Palestine is the exception. That's the third rail of political speech, of academic speech, of free speech, and that's now being seriously brought into question. And I don't think we'll go back. I mean, I think that the students are winning this, and then it's just going to be a question of how long until it actually, you know, until the win goes all the way through.
Just a few more questions here. I've seen voices who may not have agreed with your piece in the Verso blog, but also said that, you know, what you're doing is protected speech. So people like Sarab Amari at Compact Magazine, I think, have defended you. I've even seen some pro-Israel voices say, you know, I would not necessarily take a class with Jody Dean, but her speech on this should be protected. Can you talk about the responses that have, you know, essentially defended your right to express your views?
Yeah, Sarab Amari was right in there, right at the beginning. He was great, actually. It's just like, wait, this is terrible. This happened. This, what she said is horrible, but she should, you know, she has a right to say it. And then he reached out to, oh my God, the name's a major professor at Princeton, who's another big free speech person. He reached out to him. His name just blanked out of my head, but he's very important. And had him ask him to write a letter, which he did, to the president saying, again, I disagree, but this is viewpoint discrimination. This is a violation on the real fundamentals of academic freedom. But not just on the legal front or the kind of free speech principled front. You know, I got a beautiful letter from a friend of mine who's a Jewish Israeli activist in Tel Aviv. And her first email, she's like, you know, I know people, like all of the Palestinians I know and work with, did feel a sense of exhilaration seeing the kind of rupture of the Iron Dome and seeing this flight. Seeing that in no way means that you have that same feeling about the violence that follows, but it does mean that there was this sense of liberation and fight back that was really important. And she affirmed that. And she affirmed the importance of that idea for pushing back against the genocide from within Israel, because that's one of the things that she's been doing. And she is someone who has friends who are hostages. And she still was like, and so she's like, you know, I'm going to write a letter to your president, which she did. So she like calling for my reinstatement. So here's someone very much in a different, living condition from where I am. One that so many of the people who are condemning what I say, she occupies a position they claim to speak from. But she fully rejects what they're saying, right? She rejects what they're saying because she thinks of how she, one of her arguments is that, honestly, it does not let Jewish people be safe if you are attacking all kinds of free speech, all kinds of statements that let people understand and think about, what's going on, think about the conditions of Palestine, think about that history, think about their movements for freedom, that's crucial. crucial. So I've appreciated hearing, you know, I gotta say, I don't appreciate hearing from all these people who send me hate mail, but I do, I'm pretty happy when they're like, I really hate you, but I support your right to free speech and you should have your teaching position reinstated.
Much has been made over the course of the past at this point, you know, we're running on half a year now of this, about anti-Semitism. And I am someone that worries about anti-Semitism. At the same time, you know, I see figures like Larry Summers going around calling, you know, a Palestinian scholar like Rashid Khalidi an anti-Semite. And, you know, he did apologize for that. But I feel like there is a double standard towards Palestinian voices. And I think anti-Palestinian racism is not taken as seriously. Can you comment on that?
I think those are all really good points. I mean, anti-Semitism is horrible. It's disgusting. And just period. That's why it's why it has been an effective shaming tool for scholars, for activists, particularly Palestinian and Arab scholars and activists, to be called anti-Semitic. So it's a shaming word, but it is being deployed in a way that's extremely dangerous and hurts the ability to address actual cases of anti-Semitism, to recognize actual cases of Semitism, because clearly anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. To be against what the Israeli state is doing is not an anti-Semitic position. It's just kind of like, I mean, I can't imagine someone saying like, oh my God, you're criticizing the government of France. Why do you hate all French people? Like, no one would say that ever. There's just an exception in this condition. Even in a more complicated situation, like nobody thinks that criticizing and even condemning Putin means that the person is criticizing or condemning all Russians, or the same with respect to Ukraine. And that's a pretty, heated conflict, to say the least. So there's an exception here that's weaponized to protect the military and political superiority of Israel as an occupying force, as a force that's carrying out illegal settlements in the West Bank, as a force that's conducting scholasticide and ecocide, and has now killed over 34,000 Palestinians. It's wiped out what, over half the buildings in the northern part of Gaza, if not more. And what's happening and what's so great is we see with all these student encampments is they, all of them are very strongly committed to anti-racism, to opposing anti-Semitism in all its forms, and basically to securing spaces where different people can come together to talk, to live, in some cases to pray, and that this will be a space where, you know, I might not pray the way you do, but I will protect you in your doing it.
I just had two more questions and we'll wrap after that. But the first one I had is within academia, you know, we've talked about the importance of a free and open discourse here. Can you explain, how do you think within academia, you know, discourse around a subject like Israel and Palestine should be handled? What's a way that we can have a discourse where all voices are heard and there is rigorous debate?
I've got to say, it has to begin with facts and history. We can't pretend that the oppressor and the oppressed are coming to this from the same thing. It's just like in some ways there's like contemporary academia has this almost kind of fake depoliticized, though it's really deeply political, but has this fake therapy culture where a good conversation is one where everyone talks about their experience and feeling from their perspective. And it makes me think back in the day when there was like these afternoon talk shows like Murray Povich or something. It's like, oh, here's the rapist and here's the woman who raped. Y'all just hug. Just like, give me a break. Like, this is ludicrous. Like, so we've got to get rid of this kind of fake both side-ism. Like, we've seen this in anti-racist discussions in areas where finally everyone knows, like, white fragility is a problem. It's like, you can't just say, well, let's have white people in there talking about, you know, it makes me feel so bad when you call me a racist, even when Black people are dealing with systemic racism. So the kind of false equivalence of positions, a false equivalence that denies that there's actual real relations of oppression. And in Israel-Palestine, Israel is an occupying country. Israel has kept Gaza under siege for over 15 years. Israel has blocked food, water, electricity, clean water, internet. It keeps a very tight grip on what can go in and out of the territory. So it doesn't even let the West Bank control their own economy. So I think that keeping in mind, and of course, it's a nuclear power and the strongest military force in the region. And so we've got to be clear when we're talking about sort of history and both sides. That I think really matters. And then I think it's like also recognize that, any college course, there will be books that'll talk about things in different ways, and that students should be exposed to different books. And that's what the faculty does, is they provide, you know, I suggest you read this. And then if the student doesn't want to, they can take another course or go read something else.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about, in regards to the current situation with the encampments, I'm seeing a lot of really broad anti-activist and anti-protester rhetoric being deployed. We have two senators that are essentially calling for vigilante violence against protesters. Tom Cotton in particular has been pretty open saying those things. And, you know, in the past few days, we've seen tear gas deployed against protesters. We've seen, you know, professors at Emory University getting arrested and getting slammed onto concrete. You know, this is a real act of police repression we're seeing. And I feel like we're seeing an escalation when it comes to, you know, what I almost feel like is the emerging police state in America. I worry about that a lot. Can you speak to that issue?
I mean, it's a battle over the university, right? It's a battle over whether or not students can be free to be political, or they can be free to fight a genocide, to oppose a genocide. Like, we can't let the fact that there's a genocide occurring get ever pushed aside, right? We can't let the fact that there a handful of, like, what is it, a dozen or so universities who provide major support for Israel, for Israel militarily, for the companies that they're invested in, the companies that provide Israel with military, with the kind of means of destruction. So I think we have to keep all of this in mind and recognize the students are fighting back against that. And the interest of these universities is to maintain their power and to maintain the power of U.S. imperialism. And the students are saying, no, we're not going to have it. And the kind of question is going to be is, can the students and now the faculty supporter, can we win? I think we can. I don't think it's going to be easy. I mean, this may not be the end of the first round, but I think we can. I think the fight back is enormous. And now that it's escalating into these building occupations, man, it's wild to see.
I want to thank you again, Jody Dean, for taking time to speak with me. Is there anything else you want to say in closing? And do you have anything to say to, you know, for the people that were very critical of your Verso piece. Is there anything you want to say to them?
I think that I got a beautiful letter from a colleague, a retired colleague from Duke. And he told me, he's like, you know, everything that, or he told me, he wrote this letter to the president of HWS. He's like, everything that you said is known to millions of people all over the world, particularly in the global South, right? This is not, this nothing I said was strange or even controversial. But what I did was present the ideas essentially from what we could imagine as a Gazan perspective. Like, I'm not writing as a Gazan, but the position it's the piece is occupying is that kind of position we're a position that's looking for hope and that looks at the ways that a kind of culture of resistance has developed in terms of images of flight and flying, and that's what is not so common in the, you know, in the United States and the Imperial Corps and whatever you want to call it, the West, the North, right? Instead, our position has been one that begins with an insistence on the primacy of Israel. But what happens when we begin by thinking about what's going on from the perspective of those who've had, you know, the knee on their neck for 75 years or even 15 years, depending on how you want to, you know, how you want to describe it? It's going to look different, and we need to see that difference. So I would hope that people... I would hope people would read with a little more perspective, maybe a little more generosity. On the other hand, I have to say, I think there's something that may have been, I don't know, I think there was a little bit of naivete on my part, in that I was writing as if the left could have a conversation about how we understand solidarity and how we offer solidarity, and what are the and what is it to comply with the restrictions on speech given to us by imperialism, rather than rejecting those conditions. And my naivete was thinking that the left can have this conversation in this context of a you know, the strength of imperialism and Zionism that so polices everything we say and feel. And so my hope is that in different fora and different possibilities, we can have that critical conversation, because there are criticisms of me that make make a lot of sense. I mean, I have responses, but then we have to get really deep in the weeds. It doesn't work very well on a sort of a podcast or a soundbite.
Well, thank you again, Jody Dean, for coming on Parallax Views. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you found something of value in my conversation with Professor Jody Dean. I would appreciate your feedback. I've tried to be very sensitive these past months when covering Israel-Palestine, and I know this episode will probably be controversial. My interest was less in what Professor Dean said in the blog post and more in the issue of viewpoint discrimination and academic freedom. I believe that if there's ideational content, then that should be protected speech. You know, ideational content being you're making an argument for something, as opposed to, you know, for instance, just hurling epithets at someone or racial slurs. You know, that to me, in my view, is hate speech. But if there is ideational content, no matter how much that content may be something I disagree with, vehemently disagree with, if it's ideational content, then it should be protected speech. So again, I know this episode is controversial. It's going to be controversial. In any case, I welcome your feedback on it. I think we need dialogue and discourse. So, with that in mind, if you appreciate the work here I do at Parallax Views, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. One more time, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said...
Until next time... You've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. new forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.